Everybody, welcome to the April 2019 Houston Color Coaching Meetup Group. Say hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody.
We are going to talk about a unicorn in the attic, organizing myth versus reality. And I know this must be a little confusing as a topic, like what do I mean by organizing myths? But let me give you an example to get started. We all have a bunch of stuff in our closet, under the bed, in the storage unit, in storage somewhere wedged into the house, that we think is worth a whole lot of money, right? And it's probably, we think it's worth a whole lot of money, and in actuality, it's not quite worth a whole lot of money. So picture the garage sale that you're preparing to have, because it's summer and everybody starts thinking about, okay, now I'm finally gonna get around to doing that garage sale. You are going to take those items that you think are worth a whole lot of money, and you're gonna price them for 5 times what you would actually pay for them if you saw them at somebody else's sale, right? There's a name for this, and it's called the endowment effect. And it's an actual psychological explanation for why we tend to overvalue the stuff that we own. So I'm gonna read it to you because I don't wanna mislead and make it be correct. The endowment effect is an emotional bias that says that once we own something, or have a feeling of ownership at least, we irrationally overvalue it, regardless of its objective value. The endowment effect occurs for 2 psychological reasons. One of them is loss aversion. We feel the pain of loss twice as strongly as we feel the pleasure at an equal gain. So let's say you have a mug and you get a mug. You give up the mug and you feel twice as bad about that as you feel good when you get a new mug instead. Who knows why that is? It's part of our makeup. The other explanation is ownership. We fall in love with what we already have, and we're prepared to pay more to retain something we already own than we would pay for an item that we don't own. It's also shown that we're unwilling to trade something that we already own in exchange for something of equal value. So again, if you have a mug and they have a mug, you're less likely to surrender it. Like, I don't want Beth's mug because it's not mine. I want my mug, right? Even though they're practically the exact same mug. And they did some testing to support this. And so we're gonna put the link up on the video later for you to go and read the article where I pulled these explanations out. I thought it was fascinating. They actually did testing with people, and you know, and I'm saying mug because that was one of the tests. Like, they would give them a coffee mug or something else, and then they thought that all of the people given the opportunity, everybody would trade around. And the truth is, almost everybody kept the thing that they originally got, because once they received it, it endowed a sense of ownership, and that made it super, super valuable to them. And of course, the day before, they didn't own the mug, and their life was perfect, right? It's just part of how we psychologically deal with stuff. So the endowment effect creates this personal myth in your mind about what your stuff is worth. And we're going to talk about similar things today. That's my one example. But we're going to talk about other things where how we view it and what the truth is in reality are not exactly the same. And let's talk about another one now that we've already talked about value in terms of your collectibles, for instance, or the things that you've got saved in the corner. Let's talk about how a garage sale works exactly. So here's the myth about the garage sale. You're gonna have a garage sale, and you're gonna make a whole lot of money, and you're gonna not do very much work, and it's only gonna take a few hours, right? Like, in your mind, it's all gonna be super easy, and you're gonna be, you know, $2,000 at the end, and you won't have had to do anything very much to make that happen. So that's the myth. And the truth is, anybody that's had a garage sale knows that that's not true, right? And there's a reason that an estate sale company spends a week in advance of the sale prepping the house and has a whole bunch of staff people that help them do it, and they spend the whole weekend running the sale, because that's all of the work that you have to put into it to maximize the money out of your stuff. And even an estate sale that doesn't have a lot of furniture and appliances, for instance, like if you're not selling a couch and a bed and the refrigerator or a washing machine, the numbers aren't gonna be as bulky as they are when you're selling those big ticket items. And that's true at a garage sale as well. So yes, there are garage sales out there that make a whole lot of money, but the truth is, the average garage sale by the average person that you're gonna do to declutter the house instead of empty the house because you're moving is not going to be something that you're going to get a whole bunch of money for. You're not going to get rich that day, and you're going to put a whole bunch of work into it. And so just know that in advance. Don't have that dream in your head that now that it's spring, you're going to get rich at your garage sale. Okay. I put all these myths into categories because, you know, I'm an organizer and I like to organize like with like. So that was the value myth. And so now we're going to talk about myths about working with an organizer. So the first myth is, at your appointment, the organizer's there to rip things away from you against your will. And this is a myth that's sort of perpetuated because of all the TV shows. That's part of the dramatic effect of the shows, right? Or they're doing things like, and Clean Sweep, remember they used to trade out, if you give up your snow globe collection, we'll give you a new couch, right? So they were trying to fight the endowment effect, right? Like the person was holding on, it's like, don't touch my snow globes, don't touch it. And they're like, yeah, but if you give up these crazy snow globes that we don't know what to do with, we'll give you a couch. Like they tried to make the reward super big to let you let go of it. There's drama in those shows that are not part of your real life, right? And so this myth that the organizer is there to make it really hard and to snatch things away from you without your permission is not really the truth. I have to say that it's not really part of my business model to be mean to my clients or to argue with them. Like I wouldn't stay in business if I was just doing that when I went to appointments, right? And no organizer that I know works like that. The other shows that really sort of impact people's perception of what it's like to work with an organizer is the hoarder shows. When they are they're showing the dramatic effect of the organizer and the therapist in confrontation with the client and how stressful and distressing all of that is. Okay, so next myth about working with an organizer. An organizing appointment is going to be super dramatic and painful like it is on television. And I think that some people watch the hoarder shows and they watch how traumatized and distressed that person is. And they think that if they have somebody come and work with them, it's going to be like that for them. And the truth is, there is some emotion around working with somebody. And usually what happens is there's a little bit of emotion, there's a whole lot of work, and then there's a lot of relief on the other end. So while I expect there to be some emotional response to the work that we're doing, usually it's not nearly as dramatic as you see on television. And occasionally it will be dramatic and we'll have to stop and because I'm making somebody cry. But if it's because of they're picking up through the stuff that's their mother's that who died last month, or they're dealing with something that's related to the divorce, or yes, sir.
Would you give a brief explanation of the difference between a person with hoarding disorder and one that has a problem with clutter?
Yes.
Because there is a distinct difference.
Yes, there is. So he is alluding to the fact that a person who has been diagnosed with hoarding disorder has crossed a clinical diagnostic line. Please come in. A therapeutic line where they are diagnosable with what is classified in the DSM as a mental illness. And so that person is really working with an issue that needs professional intervention and perhaps medication depending on how far along in the hoarding process they are, where they are on the scale, and a lot of support from organizers and therapeutic support. Somebody who has problems with clutter is not across that diagnostic line, and that person is usually somebody who doesn't necessarily have that skill set of being organized. They don't think in that way. Their brain may not think that way. They're chronically disorganized, but they can learn coping mechanisms, and they can be supported by a smaller team. Now, it's somebody that might be diagnosed as ADD, what might need help from an organizer and also need some medical support, some prescriptions, if that would be helpful. But there's a continuum of people, and on one end of the line is excessive compulsive disorder, somebody who is super, super neat to the point of taking over their lives. That's also a clinical diagnosis on one end, and hoarding is a clinical diagnosis on the other end. And so we all sort of mostly live in the middle somewhere, and on the edges, we cross a clinical diagnostic line. So once you cross that diagnostic line, there requires some interventions by people who are much more professional than me. Like, I'm not going to be the person that A, diagnoses them, and B, works with them first. But most of the people that I work with are going to be the people in the middle that need some help and training and support with skill sets or systems or yes, ma'am.
I have a question about cluttering and just looking at myself.
Right.
My organizational skills are not an issue. And like when I'm at work, I'm very organized in the space and also in my mind. But I think with me, I had a loss, like my husband died.
Right.
And for me, like to kind of fill that void, I like to go shopping and then it kind of became out of control. So for me, that's how it developed. So I think there can be some other explanations.
Absolutely. Yeah. So like some people don't have the skill set and some people are triggered by life events, right? Like your example was you lost your husband and that was a triggering event. And so we all have coping mechanisms that kick on when we have emotional things happen in our life that we don't quite know how to cope with, or that really push the edge of our ability to cope. And so sometimes you develop coping mechanisms to help you deal in the moment with something that's traumatic, right? And so you're describing your shopping as your traumatic coping mechanism. I remember being in that place there was a time in my life when I lost a relationship and I was very depressed, and my coping mechanism was to be shopping a little bit. And it served me in the moment. And I got past it. But it is one of the ways that we try to cope with things that sort of overload our psyche, right? Overload our brain. Yeah, it's true. Thank you for that. Thank you for that question.
So you're talking about retail therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I don't think that it's, don't misunderstand. I don't think it's a great coping mechanism. I just think it's a coping mechanism.
I found Goodwill's a great place to exercise that.
Right? Well, you know, it makes it inexpensive, for sure, to go to Goodwill and shop. But, you know, then you end up with a clutter problem on the back end, right? Like, the immediate soothing, the self-soothingness of shopping in the moment has the unintended effect of creating more clutter in the house, right?
And so, it didn't cause financial problems for me because I went to places like that.
Right?
State sales
and garage sales, right?
But it was the sheer amount of things.
The
and
volume,
I didn't want
yeah.
to deal with purging things because there was an emotional component.
Right.
I just kept
right.
acquiring and accumulating.
Right. And I would say that, because I've known you for a long time now, and I would say that you're in a different mental space now.
I am.
Right? Like, your life has changed and you have gotten this much farther away from that, and you're in a new relationship and there's, you know, different things happening in your life. And so
I have a supportive partner.
Yeah.
And he's helping me with that, and I'm more motivated now, and I've kind of processed.
Yeah, processed the loss, right?
I'm more motivated to change the space and create space for someone else in my life.
Right? Yeah. That's great. Good for you. It's really, but that's a perfect example of you're okay and then something really traumatic and awful happens and you cope with it by doing something that in the short term is helpful and in the long run is detrimental. And then you have to sort of get over it and come back and clean up for yourself. And I think you've been able to do that really successfully.
It's an ongoing process.
Well, as clutter always is, right? Clutter's always an ongoing process for sure. Okay, are we done? Okay, let me go on to the next myth. The end goal of an organizing appointment is to achieve Pinterest-level perfection. Anybody that looks at Pinterest sees all these beautiful rooms that are so lovingly decorated.
Probably airbrushed.
Oh, exactly, and they're probably airbrushed. She's exactly right. That is a frozen moment in time that will stay exactly like that until your kids come home or you have to find something in the room. Those rooms on Pinterest are... Okay, everybody hold you. It's like, you know, somebody's getting ready to zap you with the things, right? And they say, pause, and everybody pulls their arms back. Like they're all making that picture, and then they say, photo, and everybody moves their arms back, and they take the picture. So it's a great thing to strive for, but the truth is that there are levels that you can aim for that are much lower than it looks like. I'm not satisfied until it looks like Pinterest. You can be satisfied with, I'm decluttered enough that I'm comfortable in the space. So the myth is the picture, and the reality is you should be aiming for the place where you feel comfortable. As long as you're happy and you feel not stressed about it and you feel like you can manage your life in it, that is exactly the place that you should aim for, okay? Here's another one. You need to add a bunch of products, or you need to spend a lot of money on products in order to get organized. So that's a big myth. She's like, no, no, no. That's right. That is a very big myth. And I get asked this question a lot when I first talk to people. They will say to me, so Gail, we're on the phone doing an assessment call. What should I do to get ready? Should I go buy some stuff? No, no. Don't go buy anything. It's okay. Products are a great part of adding in systems to the house, but they are not the systems in and of themselves. So you don't want to spend a whole bunch of money on products, because surprise, surprise, throwing everything in a pretty box is not going to solve your organizing problem, right? That's not the end solution. The end solution is that the box becomes part of a system of, I take the mail every day and I sort and I put the bills in the pretty box, right? And that's something, and then you go to pay the bills, you take the bills out of the pretty box, put the bills in, you know. It's a process where you have to change a habit and develop a habit of how you handle the bills. And where in that system of handling the bills, there's a moment in time where the bills sit in the pretty box and wait for you to come and pay. And so that is how products interact with you and interact with your systems. They're not the systems themselves, right? Don't think that you're gonna have to spend a whole bunch of money. That's my bottom line about that myth as well. It does not require a bunch of money. And most of the time I go in and there's already a whole bunch of organizing products in the house anyway, so I'm just using what's already there. And there may be something super specific that I send somebody to go get. Okay, I think you need to be able to hang your broom up over here, so you should go get one of those hanger things. But otherwise, I can usually make do with what you've got and it's just fine. Okay. Here's one. The organizer can magically make it all fit in the room that's currently 3 feet deep, and I don't have to give up anything. Yeah, that's a no. So what you're really imagining in your mind is that here's the room, and it's all a big stuffed room of chaos, and that I'm going to be able to show up, and I'm going to take that chaos, and suddenly it's all gonna fit in the room, and you're gonna be able to access it all, and you're gonna be able to walk up to it all and find everything easily and see everything, and some magically have made the room bigger somehow. So the truth of that is that I can usually make it, and any organizer can usually make it fit into the storage unit better. Like, we can pack the room in a better way, in a more orderly way, and it will look like a storage unit inside. We can install shelves, we can put in containers, we can make things fit. But if you don't let go of anything at all, it will be perfectly packed in there, and then the minute that you need something out of that room, it'll be just like you pop the chip can with the snakes that come popping out. It'll be exactly like that. As soon as you have to undo our storage, you will have deconstructed the room for yourself. And you won't likely put it back the way that we set it up. And so you won't get it, it will never go back in place. So the myth is we can make it all work perfectly and you don't have to lose anything. And the reality is, a room that's overstuffed already, you're gonna have to let go of some stuff to make it functional, to get all the goals that you want about accessibility and usability, and you can find things and you can live in it. And sorry, that's the truth. Okay, here's another one. No matter how dense it is, 4 hours is enough to fix it. You guys know that that's not true, right? So this is just an example of clean time blindness. We've talked about this before. We want it to take 4 hours because that's how long we want to work on the project. But the truth is that if it's been ignored for 6 weeks, maybe 4 hours will do it. If it's been ignored 6 months and it was clear when it started, 4 hours might be good enough. But if it's been a year, or it was super dense, it was over full to begin with, 4 hours is just getting started. 4 hours is just barely getting going. So that is something that you have to adjust for yourself, so that you make a plan to work for as long as you need to work, not in one string. I never mean in one string. You wanna make a plan to work for amount of time that you're willing to work, and to repeat that amount of time over and over until you get to the end of your project. And sorry, it can't be all done in 4 hours. I wish it could be too. Okay, let's shift to paper myths. Does anybody have any questions about any of that before I move on? Okay, cool. Here is one myth, and I give this example because I have a client who insisted that, and part of it was her age, but she insisted that we had to shred every instance of her name and her address on every piece of paper in her house, which made a huge shredding project. And she took boxes of shredding off over and over and over again to the shredder and paid to have them shredded, which was great. And I was happy to do what she wanted. But the truth is, particularly if you own your property, and she did, she owned her home, and she had lived in it for 45 years, your name and address is part of the public record. Like, they don't have to get in, nobody has to get into your trash to get your name and address, right? So the myth is, in everybody's panic to protect themselves from identity theft, that you have to shred up your name and address. And I'm saying to you, that's a whole lot of to-do, that's a whole lot of shredding to do that you don't really have to do. It's more important that you shred the data that is pertinent to you, like account numbers, social security number, medical data that you don't want people, you don't want to share, like the doctor's name or reports that show diagnosis or anything like that. What else besides social security card? Sorry, I have a list.
Credit card numbers.
Credit cards. Bank names, that's the other one. Bank names, and like if you, your bank statement with bank number on it, it has the statement number on it. Now they've gotten pretty clever about that stuff. And you know, they don't show the full number all the time anymore. They only show a portion of it. That's awesome. But if you want to be comfortable, I would shred that kind of stuff. But every name and address and every envelope that comes into your house, you do not have to be shredding that. Now, she is in her 70s, and she developed that protection mechanism when people were fishing in trash cans pre-digital for identity information. So I know where it came from for her, but that ship has kind of sailed. You can get a whole lot more information online than you ever could before. And if you own a house, it's part of the public record. So you really don't have to worry about that, is what I'm saying. Here's one about taxes. The myth is that you have to keep your taxes and the support forever or for 7 years. And the truth is that rule has changed now. It's really only 3 years. So it's 3 years personally, and there's 6-year rule for business. And I would recommend that you keep the return itself, the 10 or 20 pages of return. And then you have to keep the support for those returns for the 3-year period or the 6-year period for business. And then once that 3 years goes by, then you can pitch the support and just keep the return itself. The only caveat, I always have to say this, the rule is 3 years unless you're committing fraud, and then they can do whatever they want and I cannot help you. So you have to remember that, you know, it's 3 years unless they decide that you're doing something really, really wrong. So this is why you pay an accountant to do your tax return, right? So you don't get accused of that. Okay, so let's talk about, that's the organizer ones, that's this one. Okay, there's one more paper myth. I know you guys are gonna like this one. Someday, in your mind, the myth is, someday, when the mailman goes on vacation for 2 weeks, you'll have some free time and you'll be able to catch up on your mail. So you know that the mailman goes on vacation, but the mail delivery never goes on vacation, right? There is no point in which the mail stops. And what you have today is the smallest amount of mail. What you got in the mailbox today is the smallest amount of mail pile you're ever gonna have. And tomorrow, it's double that. And by the end of the week, it's 6 times that. And so there's nothing about mail that can be solved by ignoring it. Mail is really something you have to pay attention to. You have to develop a habit. If you develop no other habits to decluttering in your life, if you just develop a habit for handling the mail every day or every other day or a couple times a week so that you stay ahead of it, that will make your life 1,000 times better. Can you agree with that, Margaret?
Absolutely.
I've helped you with your mail, and I think you've gotten a lot better about it, right?
I've gotten somewhat better.
It's something that if you can develop a habit of dealing with as much as you can when it comes in, the better off you will be. And there's no way for that to not be true, and I've said it 100 times. The mail will come for 3 months after you're dead. Like, there is no intersection of you having the desire to work on it and the mail stops coming so you can, you know, not be bothered by anything new. Yes, ma'am.
I have a problem with mail, and a friend gave me a tip that I really didn't believe. He said, if it's not first class mail, just throw it away. And I kept opening that. He would say, throw that away, and I would open it, and it would be nothing, and I'd throw it away. It would be something I didn't need. So I finally am able to do that, although I have that dreaded
fear. The little moment of, right?
But it's really true.
That was really good advice.
Right? And if you think about it, if they're mailing you a check, they're not mailing it third class, they're mailing it first class. If they're sending you a legal notice, they're not sending it third class, they're sending it first class. All the important stuff in your life is gonna come first class. That's a good idea. Yeah. Mail is a problem for everybody, it's not just you. Like, everybody has some fight with mail. And even I don't love hassling with the mail, but I get an immense amount of satisfaction out of bringing in today's mail and going, trash, trash, shred, la, 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 la. Like, I beat you today, mail. Sometimes I get a big thrill out of that. It's something to accomplish, and you get the win every day. Like, if you do the mail and you get to put it all in the trash in one day, that's super awesome to me. And I, you know, I'm easy to please, right?
Another thing that helped enormously is I quit taking the paper.
Oh, yeah. The paper is a big burden for people.
No, just help me put these things out.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, newspapers are wonderful. And as long, you know, my dad reads the newspaper every day. So he has a process of reading the paper and putting it aside and putting it out to recycle. But a lot of times people take paper and then they don't have the time to keep up with it. And then it gets backed up. And again, at the end of 6 days, you've got a whole stack of papers you don't have time to read, right? Okay. Let's talk about some myths related to productivity. Here's one that I hear occasionally. It's not worth doing it. It's not worth organizing my space. It's not worth organizing fill in the blank unless I can make it perfect. So the problem with that statement is the perfect part in it. A lot of people let perfect, attaining perfection, be the enemy of done or getting anywhere or getting started. And somehow, I find that people that get stuck in that zone, they're waiting to figure out the way to go from zero to finished in this most streamlined, perfect path that has no waste and gets exactly the results in the shortest amount of time. So they sort of set this bar that seems really impossible to make, and then they let the fact that they can never find that path keep them from doing anything. I see that look on your face. You're like, I have met many clients who are cluttered because they're frozen by the need to attain perfection. And in my head, there's a long and winding road to perfection. And it is all, this is the, and we should be able to get it all done in 4 hours, right? Like, there may be a whole lot of work you have to be doing between starting and finishing into a place where you find it perfect to look at. And so stage one is going to be removing all the stuff that doesn't belong there. And stage two is going to be rearranging the stuff that you kept. And stage three is going to be trying a process and living with it in real life and seeing if it really works. And you're not going to be able to do all that in one sitting or one amount of focus. Somehow, people who get tripped up by this want to be able to focus on it, and in the amount of time that they're willing to focus, get to the end. Like, it has to be, here's my big ugly problem, and I'm going to focus on it for 20 minutes or 3 hours or a day, and at the end it's going to be perfect and finished. And there is no clutter project, hardly ever, that is that short. They can be done that way. And so achieving perfection is really a crippling myth that really gets in the way of you making attainable steps over time until you get to the finished product. And you know, the perfect example of this is I go and work in people's houses and we want to get it done. They want to get their whole house done. And then I spend a year going over to their house every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks or once a week or twice a week in some cases. And I spend 50 weeks doing that at their house. And it takes all of that time to get through their house from one end to the other. That's how much life and backed up stuff and things to shred and stuff to get rid of and kids' things to disperse and fill in the blank is in the house that has to be manhandled. And it takes some time. And so the idea that you can come up with a perfect solution the first time without any mistakes and be happy in the result is really just a crippling self-judgment, I think, instead of a real path to attainment. Now you can get to perfect at the other end, but you're gonna have to do a bunch of steps to get there. And so changing your mind about, okay, it's not perfect today, but I can be aiming for perfection. And every time I come back and tweak it more and more and more, it gets more perfect. Because of course, perfect is the ultimate illusion, right? It's never going to be 100% perfect. Yes, ma'am.
I think we've been spoiled by the organizing shows. You
right.
Know, like Clean Sweep, where, you know, they come into a house that's like full of junk from the floor to the ceiling, and the family goes off for 4 days, and then they come back, and their house looks like magic.
Yeah, it looks like a model home, right?
It's like a model home, and it's like you have some hype idea in your head that, like, after doing one appointment with you, your house is going to look like that.
It's going to be fabulous, yeah. Right? Or you're going to spend, you and your husband are going to spend the weekend working on it, and then at the end, all will be well. And it's like, well, that's not really honoring how much blood, sweat, and tears it's going to take to get the work done. I mean, it's a physical job on the one hand, and then there's all this emotional processing that goes with, is it staying, is it going, can I let it go, can I surrender the endowment effect that I have about the object, because it's mine, can I let go of that object and put it in the goodwill bag and let it go? And it takes a lot of work, and it's just not something that you can achieve in a really short period of time. Now, you know, I can work on a little project, and sometimes the way that you can get to perfection is to pick a smaller, much smaller, let's uncover the table, let's uncover the dresser, let's empty this drawer. And I just had a client this week tell me, you know, I heard you suggest on the video, and so I went and stood in my bathroom and I opened this drawer and I organized this one drawer. And she was thrilled. Like, she spent an hour, she threw away half the contents. It was makeup and toiletries and stuff, and she threw away stuff that was old. And in the end, she knew what was all in there, it was all organized, she had little containers and she was happy. But it's because it was, you know, 1 foot by 2 feet piece of real estate, right? Like, that's why it took an hour. Okay, so that's perfection. Here's another myth. There's an organizing system that works for everyone. Yeah, see? Yeah, no, that's a no. So the current clutter guru is Marie Kondo, and everybody is madly in love with Marie Kondo. But the truth is, her technique of sparking joy, you know, keep it if it sparks joy, and if it doesn't spark joy, thank it for its service and let it go. This is a system that's working for some people, but it's not working for everybody. And there is no, that's why some people watch my channel and some people go, she didn't know what she's talking about, and they go watch somebody else. There is no one system that's going to work for everybody. And so you can try versions until you find one that resonates for you. Right? If Marie Kondo isn't it, if you don't like the Johnny Come Lately, then you can wait for the next one, or you can go back in time and try some other people that have had their moments in the sun. There's lots of options out there. There's a million books out there. There's a million channels like mine out there. Somebody will speak to you. And all we're really trying to do, everybody's trying to talk about it in some way that brings you the ability to understand how you intersect with the stuff and how you can make changes around the stuff. We're all just trying to train. We're all trying to make your point of view be shifted and different. And if Marie Kondo isn't it, don't worry about it. Move on to the next person, right? There are people that swear by it and swear it's changed their lives. And then there are people that are like, oh my gosh, I cannot possibly fill my t-shirts like that woman. What is she thinking? Like, it's everybody sees it differently. So you can pick the one that works for you. Okay, let's talk about judgment myths. I'm trying to watch the time. Here is what I mean by judgment is the ways that we judge ourselves. Okay, so the biggest myth that I hear from my client base, the people when they finally call me, is I should be able to do it all by myself. Like they're calling me in total surrender because they've given up. They've tried and tried and tried, and they're beating themselves up over the head. I should be able to do it by myself. I should be able to do it by myself. I shouldn't have to pay you to come and help me. And then my question is always, why? Do you have the skill set? Do you consider yourself an organized person, or do you find that that's not really your skill? If it's not your skill set, then you shouldn't give yourself a hard time about not being able to be organized. You should give yourself the moment to learn from someone who understands how to organize and learn some skills. We don't all come in with magic skills. We don't all come in with the magic ability to cook. And truthfully, yes, I could learn to cook, but then I would have to shoot myself. I hate being in the kitchen. The whole process of cooking just makes me want to scream. And other people, like, this is their life's joy, right? To make food and be all fancy about it. And all, like, I get that there's an appeal for everybody about the things that they like to do. We don't all have the skill set of being organized. And we can all learn to some degree. And you learn from people that know how to do it, right? Yes, ma'am.
Well, what if you're organized in one aspect, but you're not organized in your home?
Right.
So, like, at work, I'm OCD. My bedroom closet is ridiculous. So my main issues in my home is my bedroom closet and my mail. That's it. Everything else is clean. So I do have organization skills. There's
right.
just something missing.
Right. Well, so think about the difference between the home and the office. One, your office is 100 square feet. Your home is 2,000 square feet. So you are, one is a microcosm of space, one is a much larger space. The second thing is that organizing paper and organizing clothes, two different skill sets, you have to do two different things to make those things be organized. So you may understand and already have skills for one and not have translatable skills to the other kind. So that's okay. It just means that you need to learn some techniques. Get some suggestions and apply them. And it may be that some of the techniques that you use for one will morph and change slightly differently to work on another. Just like if you watch the hoarding shows, this is a perfect example. Some people hoard animals. Some people hoard food. Some people hoard stuff. And they're not interchangeable. Like this person doesn't do usually all of that. And this person doesn't do these two things, right? Like everybody has a different, you know, focus in their brain. And so some of the stuff works for you and some of the stuff you just need some training on. And that's okay. You're ahead of the game that you already have some experience of being organized and you have some skills that are working in an area for you. And so it's just a matter of, okay, how can I leverage those and apply to this new technique? The other difference between office and home, office, everybody sees it. People that are not your family, people that not aren't in love with you, people that are not born of your loins see your office.
Well, then, yeah, that's true. Because
right?
No one sees my bedroom, but everywhere else in the house that people see is...
Right? So we really focus on public areas because of the shame that goes with if our public areas look bad, we feel embarrassed. But in the hidey hole that is our bedroom that no one gets to come in without extreme express permission, we can ignore that because the only person that benefits is us, right? So part of how I try to address that with people is you need to think of yourself as valuable and worthy of that sort of attention and environment, just like the people that you don't know very well that come in your living room. Like the choice that you're making is, I make it pretty for the potential popover guest, or I make it pretty when all my friends come to hang out for board games or whatever, visitors, but I'm not valuable enough to live in a pretty space either. Now, it is, you're making a choice between in that space, you're being motivated by potential embarrassment, right? So you're being motivated by a negative emotion. If my friends come over and the house is a wreck, I'm going to be embarrassed. Therefore, I'm going to clean. But in the bedroom, the only person that's going to see it is you, so you don't really have that negative motivation happening. So you got to find another motivation to make it work. And some of it can be that you feel less stressed when the bedroom is clean. Like, you're talking to me about it now, so I'm guessing that it's taking up mental space for you.
Yeah.
Right? It's
my
like
closet
is bothering you, right? And so making the effort when the only reward is it makes it better for you, you need to get okay with that being a big enough reward. And truthfully, you go in that closet every day of your life. You spend hours in that closet, right?
Not hours.
But in a week, you know, you go every morning, you go every night.
Step in and step out.
And having that function for you well and easily would be a huge improvement in your life, right? So letting you be the only winner of your effort and the only recipient of the benefit needs to step up in your importance. It has to be important that you are the only benefit. You get the only benefit out of it. Right?
Very interesting. I never thought of it that
way. But it's like a shift in your brain, right? I know that, you know, I madly clean the house when the bee chicks are coming over. Right? Like, I got the vacuum out, because I don't want to be vacuumed all the time. But that is me being negatively motivated by embarrassment. And the truth is, I like it when the carpet's vacuumed. I think it looks nice. And so I try to motivate myself to do it just so that Penny and I are happier in the house, right? We think it's better, and we don't have to have the beady chicks come over to make us do it. Although it has happened, I will, you know, acknowledge.
We hear from a lot of people about, you know, I'm great at work, I'm terrific at the office, but my own fill in the blank is a disaster. And I think another factor in that is, at work, you're accountable to someone, and you're under the microscope, and also, you have to be there a certain number of hours. They expect you to be there, and so when you're finished the urgent things, you tidy, and you straighten, and you file, and you do all that stuff. And at home, nobody's paying you to do that. And
true that, brother man, that is so true.
But you know, if you, kind of adding on to what you said about consider your own worth.
Yeah.
You know, you should, you know, maybe try to find a way to think of it as, I deserve this clean space, and so for this 45 minutes every Wednesday, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to manage my closet because I'm worth it, and I will love the space that I have. You know.
On the other, and he makes a good point too that. When you're at work, you're there, A, during your most productive time. Like, you wake up and you've had coffee and breakfast, right? And then you go and put all your productive hours to the place that pays you to be productive. And then you come home at the end of the long day and it's been hard and you're exhausted. And then you're supposed to, like, summon up a bunch of extra energy to work on your own stuff. And that's hard. I mean, it's a hard thing to ask yourself to do when you're running out of steam. So, A, taking small bits after a long productive day, and then finding free time on your off days to address stuff that's important to you so that you can attack the closet when you are rested and you've had breakfast and coffee, like when you're the most productive and alert. Going into a tackle it then instead of at 8 o'clock at night after you're exhausted, yeah, we're all gonna fail at that point, right? It's not gonna work otherwise. So giving good energy and good focus to it at home like you do at the office where they pay you to pay attention and like do the right thing, finding that energy for yourself is the way to tackle it and get somewhere. And not try to jam it all in on one day. Like, don't go in and do a closet and spend 12 hours and you're not done and then you're like exhausted and you've ruined your weekend. Go in and spend 2 hours and do one rod. And then come back next Saturday and do another rod. Like, there's nothing that says you have to do it all in one sitting if you don't have that kind of energy and you have other weekend commitments for fun. I don't want to take all your fun away either, right? Okay, one other judgment myth is, I'm disorganized because I'm lazy. I don't hear that one directly to me as much, but I know that people think it a lot. And it's very self-judgmental to say, yeah, I'm just too lazy to do that. And I think that people start having that self-talk in their head because someone around them is saying it to them. Like somebody else is saying, your house is a wreck because you're lazy. No, that's not it, no. You may be resistant. You may be tired at the end of the day. You may not think that organizing is fun, and I totally get it. But I would bet 9 times out of 10, that's just you being judgy. That's, you're just being harsh with yourself. And setting up the, you know, the tape in your head, I am disorganized because I'm lazy, like sets you up for failure right from the get-go. Like you've already decided it's not gonna work. Yes, ma'am.
I would say to add to that, kind of like her closet, like my closet's a nightmare, but a lot of the other spaces look better now, but like my closet is overwhelming. And so I think that sense of overwhelm, like, oh, this is too much, or where do I get started with this, or, you know.
Right.
And when I know, logically, to have manageable small steps, but I'm not always thinking logically.
Right.
Just, you know, the sense of overwhelm.
When you're deep in the overwhelm, it is sometimes hard to go, oh wait, Gail says to take a small step, right? Yeah, I just take a small step. So some people laugh and say to me, I think in my head, what would Gail tell me in this moment? Like I'm feeling overwhelmed, what would Gail tell me? And I would say to you, take the small step, right? And so in a closet, the small step is always the floor. That's always my first step. You cannot walk into the closet and work on the closet if you can't touch the floor. Mm-hmm. So ignore everything over your head. Ignore everything that's not on the ground. If it's touching the ground, you can deal with it and start there. If you can only get a foot before you are completely overwhelmed, then get a foot and walk away and come back later. Yes, sir.
There are truly people that are lazy in this world.
Well, right.
But with that said, I'm big on the small house movement, where you can only have as much stuff as you absolutely need to function.
Yeah.
And if you're lazy, you need to downsize to the point where you just have maybe one plate and a fork and a knife.
Right. Well, and you know, managing a whole lot of stuff is exactly what you're saying. Like it takes a lot of effort to manage a full house of stuff. And if this is perpetually a problem, one of the ways that you can address that is to shrink the amount of stuff you're trying to manage. And the people that do tiny houses, they shrink down to the size of your office, right? They shrink down to 200 square feet, and if it doesn't fit in there, they can't have it, and then that's all they have to manage. They only have to manage 200 square feet. It's sort of like living in a dorm room, but you know, you could manage it when it was a dorm room size, right? It means that you owe tens of thousands of items less than you do in a big house. And so you don't have to manage all those items. And there's something to be said for that. If you can go down from 4,000 square feet, you know, Texas size, to 1,000 square feet, you can accomplish the same thing. And anybody that gets to the stage of their life where they're saying, I am now leaving the house that I raised my kids in, and I'm gonna move into an independent living, or I'm gonna move into a townhome, or I'm gonna move, you know, to go live and get into a smaller space, that process is shedding all of the items that fit in all the extra square footage, and then you get to a smaller space and there's less to manage, and how thrilling and exciting. If you can do that without moving, more's the better. That's a great idea. Aim for tiny house contents, even if you don't have a tiny house. Okay, the last one I'm gonna tell you about, and then we're done. A storage unit will solve your clutter problem. Yeah, no. That's no. All that really means is that you are expensively outsourcing your clutter problem to some place because of the endowment effect, right? Like it's still so important to you as the ownership that you're willing to pay more money to keep the thing off-site. But that's not really going to solve the problem. So there's some short-term reasons to have a storage unit. But as a long-term solution, parking it in a storage building and forgetting it for the next decade, so not worth the money you're gonna spend for that. You should spend that money on me and let me come and permanently let go of it. And then you will, and then it will stop, the payments will stop, and you will not own that stuff anymore. Okay, anybody else have any questions before we go? Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any advice for a shuffler? So
define shuffler.
What I did last weekend is I took one corner of my closet floor.
Right.
I moved it into the bathroom. I spent maybe an hour, and then the rest of it was just left on my bathroom floor. So now I have two messy spots.
Right. So did you put some back in the closet?
No, I left it there because I wanted to see the clear spot in my closet.
You transferred it to another location.
Yes, so that's what I call a shuffler.
Right?
I just kind of relocate it sometimes.
So I would start your project differently because I hear your difficulty with the process. So I would go into your closet and start pulling out things that can go without making any other changes. Just walk up to the rod or get onto the floor and just pick up things that you know, I'm not wearing that, that shoe is deteriorating. Every once in a while I'll go in a shoe box that's been there for a little while and I'll pull it out and the plastic outside of it has turned into sticky, like it's disintegrating in place. The shoe is still perfect except that it's, you know, right? It's decomposing in front of you. So go looking for things that you know can go.
There's
right
no
now.
Question that I'm gonna
yeah,
say
like you know it's done.
Which ended up what happened? I threw out a whole bunch of shoes.
Right? Yeah. So just keep going through that process until you get all of the easy decisions out. That will reduce the volume, and then you can start batch processing little bits of it at a time and see if that makes it easier for you. If you can reduce the volume some, it might make it work better. Okay, it's 8 o'clock. I don't want to keep you guys later. Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it. See you later.
Thank you.
Bye.